picked us because there were rooms there for two people. Now, for my own part, one sees there's children and families coming in, but two men in one room, well, we were like families as well. We are human beings. And the fact that it's two of us men doesn't mean we can't be a family as well. We can be a family as well. And there were many things that happened at the hotel. Everything was pretty much at peace. I don't know why they made this decision to send us to that place at this time. They really should have sought another place. It doesn't matter in terms of the exact conditions, but somewhere at least where it wouldn't be so cold. They placed us by a lake during the cold part of the year.
Part of our interview this week with Reuben, an asylum seeker evicted from a New York City hotel, and Desiree Joy Frias, a community organizer with South Bronx Mutual Aid. To watch the full interview and to hear about Reuben's journey from Venezuela through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, perhaps 7 countries before he made it to the U.S.-Mexico the border, and then made his way to New York, go to democracynow.org. Oh, and a very happy birthday to Hugh Grann. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Jarena Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, starting Friday, February 3rd, until Saturday, March 4th. Screenings will take place every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, bringing live interviews with filmmakers, community conversations, and more. Films will be screened at PCC Cascade, Hollywood Theater, and virtually. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org. That's the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, happening throughout the month of February in celebration of Black History Month. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland Police Union president, who was fired for a fake hit-and-run leak, is reinstated to his job.
Multnomah County announces ambitious plans to house unsheltered Portlanders.
And the January jobs numbers are strong, 3 times better than economists predicted.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 3rd, 2023. I'm Claire Rosciato.
And I'm Josh Salem. Former Portland Police Union President Brian Hunziker has been reinstated after being fired last year for his role in leaking false information about a hit and run. That leak falsely connected then-Commissioner Joanne Hardesty to a hit and run. An internal affairs investigation revealed that Hunziker shared the false report with the Oregonian, partly as payback for Hardesty's criticism of Portland police. That was a violation of policy on dissemination of information, confidentiality, and retaliation. Mayor Ted Wheeler fired him. A labor arbitrator with the Oregon Employee Relations Board has now overturned that decision, saying Hunziker's actions did not warrant termination. It's not the first time a labor arbitrator has overturned police discipline. In 2010, Portland police officer Ron Froschauer was fired for shooting Aaron Campbell, an unarmed 25-year-old black man, in the back, killing him. The city paid out $1.2 million to his family, but a labor arbitrator reinstated Froschauer in 2012. The arbitrator argued in Hunziker's case that the act of leaking the false information and Hunziker's motive were different issues, and firing him for leaking false information was wrong.
Multnomah County has new plans to quickly house hundreds of people experiencing unsheltered homelessness in the next few months. The project is called Housing Multnomah Now, and it plans to help get people into vacant apartments by incentivizing landlords to rent unhoused Portlanders. The housing first structure mirrors that of an earlier program in the county called Move In Multnomah. That project promised landlords 12 months of rent paid by the county and extra compensation for damages. 214 people were housed through the program at a cost of $4 million. County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson says the county will use $14 million left over from the Metro Supportive Housing Services tax to fund the program. They also say they will tailor the program to go neighborhood by neighborhood. The county also plans to have a dedicated staff person to mediate between tenants and landlords as needed. Vega Peterson says the goal is to get people into a stable living environment where they can work with support providers to address other needs. That could include transitioning to permanent housing, getting access to behavioral health services, and getting a job or getting an ID card.
In the next 4 months, the county wants to get 300 people into permanent housing. The focus will be in downtown Portland, Old Town, and the Central East Side. From there, they plan to shift focus to getting unhoused residents of East County into permanent housing by January 2024. Multnomah County also plans to have Housing Multnomah County Now work along Portland's Safe Rest Villages shelters in planned sanctioned outdoor camps. Vega Peterson says that speeding up housing placement will also help move people out of shelters faster and open up more beds in the county. Vega Peterson said, quote, "The only real long-term solution to homelessness is getting someone into a home. We need landlords to respond urgently to provide those living on our streets with a safe place to stay," end quote. Multnomah County has not yet identified landlord or service provider partners. Vega Peterson must still ask the county board to allocate the $14 million needed for her plan. She also called on state lawmakers to pass Governor Tina Kotek's $130 million proposed emergency funding for housing and homelessness.
More than 600 city workers went on strike Thursday, following stalled contract negotiations within the city. Wastewater treatment, park maintenance, and street clearing are likely to be impacted by the strike. Members of the Portland City Laborers Union, Local 483, had been in talks with city officials since last March for wage increases in response to a rising cost of living. The union wants a 7.9% of living adjustment, or COLA, to match U.S. inflation. They want no caps for future cost of living increases and higher wages to make jobs more competitive with the private sector. The city maintains that they don't have the money to meet the union's demands. Contract talks with the city have been going on since March. The previous contract expired in June. At a pre-strike rally last weekend, workers emphasized the critical role they played keeping the city running during the height of the pandemic. Eric Payne is a Portland Parks and Recreation maintenance worker who is on strike. Payne told OPB, quote, "Whenever stuff goes down, we're always there, but we're always forgotten when it comes time to renew a contract." Mayor Wheeler authorized the city to hire temporary contract workers in response to the strike. So far, it's not clear how the cost of hiring temporary workers compares to meeting union contract demands.
Representative Ilhan Omar is ousted from the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and the Inspector General testifies on PPP loan fraud. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
My leadership and voice will not be diminished if I am not on this committee for one term.
Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar has been ousted from her appointment on the Foreign Affairs Committee by a vote of 218 to 211 because of comments about Israel that have been considered anti-Semitic. House Republicans have said this is legitimate cause to remove her from the panel, but House Democrats say it's purely an act of retribution. Congress remains divided over how to proceed with the debt ceiling. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said he's not interested in passing a clean debt ceiling increase without government spending reforms. But Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer thinks the real trouble with passing a debt ceiling will be dissent among House Republicans.
We believe the House cannot pass a debt ceiling bill the way they're talking about it. That if it is very minor cuts, the MAGA Republicans will rebel. If it is major cuts, the more mainstream Republicans will rebel.
Democrats have been calling on Republicans for a concrete plan instead of constantly saying cuts have to be made. Although both parties are unified on the need to raise the debt ceiling, there's plenty of division on how the process should occur. According to a 2022 poll from the Peter G. Robinson Foundation, 83% of voters want the president and Congress to take more time to address the national debt, with many feeling it needs to be a top priority. Inspector General Michael Horowitz testified before the House Oversight and Accountability Committee on federal COVID-19 relief programs. One topic was fraud in the Paycheck Protection Program and unemployment assistance programs. A study from the University of Texas at Austin finds 1.4 million PPP loans appear fraudulent. This equates to about $64 billion in taxpayer money. Horowitz said it might be close to $100 billion, but he's determined to uncover all fraud that occurred with these programs.
We're going to be counting and figuring this out for years to come. We're going to go after every penny we can.
House Democrats are pushing for the Ensuring Women's Right to Reproductive Freedom Act. The bill would establish a private right of action for women to travel across state lines to obtain an abortion. It would also affirm the Attorney General's enforcement authority to bring civil lawsuits in a case where a person is prevented from or retaliated against for traveling. Although no state has enacted a law banning travel, Missouri has a pending bill that enforces abortion restrictions through civil lawsuits. Washington Representative Marilyn Strickland noted safe reproductive health care comes with the ability to go elsewhere if you need it.
We want to make sure that the ability to get access to safe and legal abortion is available for all people, regardless of your background. And the ability to travel is definitely part of that.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The American unemployment rate is the lowest it's been since the moon landing. That's right. According to the Jobs Growth Report, the unemployment rate dropped to 3.4%, the lowest since 1969. In January, the U.S. economy added 517,000 jobs. Besides some high-profile layoffs in the tech and media sectors, the broader economy is doing well. Analysts say this should change any expectations that the U.S. economy is headed for a recession. The Fed plans to continue interest rate hikes in order to try to control inflation. The new job reports indicates that more aggressive rate hikes aren't triggering massive layoffs or a spike in unemployment. The job openings and labor turnover survey from December showed 11 million available jobs at the end of last year. In context, that means there's around 2 jobs open for every 1 person looking for work. That means it's still a workers' market, and dreams of forcing workers back into in-person office work are still out of reach. The jobs numbers are significantly better than what analysts expected, even with a rosy view. Economist Justin Wolfers tweeted, quote, "My meta theory of why so many people have been wrong about the economy for so long is that many economists are incapable of acknowledging that sometimes good things happen."
Most public transit travel will be free in the greater Portland area tomorrow to honor the civil rights figure Rosa Parks. Parks was arrested on December 1, 1955, for refusing to relinquish her seat to a white passenger in Montgomery, Alabama. It was an act of protest against Jim Crow-era racial bus segregation, and it helped to spark the Montgomery bus boycott. Parks' protest was an integral moment early in the American Civil Rights Movement. TriMet buses, Max Line trains, and the Portland streetcar are among those services stopping fare collection on this date. Ticket machines will decline purchases, and riders attempting to pay by hop card will not be charged. Fare collection will restart at 2 a.m. on February 5th.
You're listening to KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be wet and rainy with an overnight low of 39 degrees. Tomorrow, that rain continues with a daytime high of 50 degrees. Today in history, in 1966, the Soviet Union spacecraft Luna 9 becomes the first spacecraft to make a soft landing on the moon, and the first spacecraft to take pictures from the surface of the moon. The quote of the day is from Franco-American literacy critic George Steiner, who passed this day in 2020. He said, quote, "When a language dies, a way of understanding the world dies with it, a way of looking at the world."
The Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, is at risk in a challenge at the Supreme Court. But state-level versions of the law can protect tribal sovereignty and Native children. A bill in front of the Montana legislature would do just that. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A coalition of Bristol Bay tribes, community members, Native corporations, and organizations in Alaska is celebrating the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's action to stop the proposed Pebble Copper and Gold Mine project from being built. On Monday, the EPA issued a final determination protecting the salmon-rich Bristol Bay watershed under the Clean Water Act. The EPA determined certain discharges associated with developing the Pebble Mine will have adverse effects on salmon fisheries in the Bristol Bay watershed. The tribe's Bristol Bay residents, commercial and sport fishers, environmental groups, and others have long fought for the protection of fish, water, and people in the region. In 2010, Bristol Bay tribes first formally petitioned the EPA to protect the pristine watershed under the Clean Water Act. The tribes of Bristol Bay Native Association, the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, and the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation released statements Tuesday calling the moment historic and celebrating the protection of their lands, water, and cultures. Developers, the Pebble Limited Partnership, in a statement said, the preemptive action against Pebble is not supported legally, technically, or environmentally, and they'll likely take legal action. Monday's decision follows years of litigation and a 2020 key Pebble Mine permit denial by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. A joint resolution to recognize the history and trauma of Indian boarding schools and asking for a day of remembrance was recently heard in the Montana legislature. Montana Public Radio's Ellis Julin reports.
Democratic Senator Susan Weber from Browning is carrying the resolution, which asks the 68th legislature to recognize the trauma inflicted by removing American Indian children from their families and sending them to boarding schools. Senator Weber is a member of the Blackfeet Nation and shared her firsthand experience as a survivor of these schools, having attended the Cutbank boarding school until junior high.
I wanted to bring this bill because my generation is the last generation that had to go to boarding school. We had to go to boarding school. Now, I'm not 150 years old. This was still going on in the 60s.
The resolution also asks the U.S. government to create a national day of remembrance for the children that died in boarding schools. The U.S. Department of the Interior published a report last year as part of an ongoing investigation into the country's past assimilation policies. That report found 408 boarding schools across 37 states, including 18 sites in Montana. More than a dozen people gave testimony in support of the resolution in its first committee hearing. There were no opponents. The Senate Education and Cultural Resources Committee did not immediately take action on the bill. For National Native News, I'm Ellis Julin.
The Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation Board of Trustees has legalized hemp and marijuana on the reservation. On Monday, the Board of Trustees voted to amend the criminal code to legalize the possession of marijuana on the reservation in Oregon. The change goes into effect immediately for people 21 years and older to consume and possess marijuana. Tribal laws will be similar to state laws, but any business on the reservation related to marijuana or hemp will be addressed in future codes and regulations. According to the Board of Trustees, the alignment of laws will help the tribe have the option of compacting with the state for any future business in the industry if the tribe chooses to do so. And in New York, the St. Regis Mohawk Tribal Council has adopted a cannabis consumption lounges amendment. The tribal clerk notified tribal membership on Monday that no written comments were received on the amendment, which was signed by the tribal council last week. The membership was given 30 days to comment on the cannabis ordinance. A consultation session was also held earlier in January. The tribe's cannabis control board is now authorized to issue consumption lounge licenses. Lounges may only sell cannabis products, and other approved items to people 21 and older. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Biochar is a form of charcoal created from heating organic matter in fires. The product enriches soil and captures carbon, meaning it could be a tool for addressing climate change. Eric Tegedoff has more in Montana.
A product known as biochar could provide a tool for capturing more carbon in the soil. Biochar is a form of charcoal created from heating organic biomass, such as from forest fires. It's gaining in popularity as a tool for enriching soil, including among Western Montana farmers. Chuck Hassebrook is the director of the Biochar Policy Project with the National Center for Appropriate Technology.
As that biochar from historic forest fires and prairie fires gradually breaks down, if we can replace it, it can do good for our soil, our farm productivity, our forest health, as it removes carbon from the atmosphere and puts it in soil where it will do good.
The use of biochar is still in its infancy. Hassebrook says one challenge to more widespread adoption is that there aren't enough processing facilities for the material. But he notes that more knowledge about biochar's benefits could create more demand, adding that it can improve a farm's resilience to extreme weather.
Soils that are mended with biochar can absorb more of the rainfall when you have a heavy downpour, and they hold it there for subsequent periods when you need that moisture, when the temperatures are hot and rainfall is hard to come by.
Hassebrook says biochar has been gaining momentum in Washington, D.C., where Montana Senator John Tester was among the sponsors of the Biochar Research Network Act in 2022. He says the research funded in a measure like this would make the product more useful.
We need the research base to sort out which type of biochar is going to be most beneficial in different soils and circumstances so that we can say to farmers and ranchers and foresters that if you use this type of biochar in this soil and in these circumstances, these are the results you're going to get.
For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff. This story was produced with original reporting from Lisa Held for Civil Eats.
Utility workers are seeing firsthand the consequences of extreme weather. Researcher Katerina Gonzalez is working with one utility to engage frontline workers in climate adaptation efforts and tap into their local knowledge. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When extreme rain hits, water utility workers need to respond quickly to keep communities safe from flooding, sewer overflows, and other hazards.
These folks are in the trenches, literally dealing with extreme events.
Katerina Gonzalez is a researcher at the University of Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership. She's helping Seattle Public Utilities find ways to engage their frontline workers in preparing for more extreme weather.
Oftentimes, planning for adaptation is siloed in like planning departments or policy departments, and they don't value the lived experience of the frontline workers.
But she says these workers have a wealth of on-the-ground knowledge, and they can provide utilities with valuable feedback on how plans are working, if new strategies or equipment are needed, or how to better allocate resources. She says as climate change brings more heavy rain, these employees are shouldering a growing workload.
We're seeing more overtime hours during these extreme events, more staff on standby, more concern about safety.
So she says it's important to include workers in climate adaptation planning. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
February is National Heart Month, and doctors are hoping people will prioritize learning the differences between a heart attack and cardiac arrest. The two terms are often used interchangeably, but there are differences that could help save a life. Edwin J. Vieira has the details.
February is National Heart Month, and doctors want Virginians to understand heart health a bit better, specifically heart attacks and cardiac arrest. According to the CDC, more than 800,000 people have heart attacks every year, and the majority are first-time heart attacks. Cardiac arrest can involve numerous factors, and heart attack is the most common. Virginia cardiologist Dr. Benjamin Galper says this is partly why the two get mixed up. He says typically signs of a heart attack can be chest pressure, nausea, or sweating, but the signs of cardiac arrest are more dire.
Cardiac arrest itself is not subtle. If you've gotten to the point of cardiac arrest, that means the person is unconscious, that they don't have a pulse when you take their pulse, and they're not breathing. So when someone's had cardiac arrest, it's usually obvious and usually quite concerning.
National Heart Month is a good time to commit to reducing those risks with a heart-healthy diet and regular exercise. Galper also encourages people to get CPR training to be able to aid someone having a heart attack until first responders arrive and possibly save a life. Underlying diseases such as diabetes or pre-diabetes can make a person more susceptible to heart problems. Dr. Ravi Yohar with United Healthcare says genetics can be another risk factor.
things like Marfan syndrome increases the risk of aneurysms and abnormal blood flow to the heart and things of that sort. So there can be some genetic consequences. There can also be genetic history. If your parents had problems with their hearts, there's a higher likelihood that you may.
He adds, heart disease can affect people at any age. CDC research finds it can start as early as 35, and the risks increase with age. Anyone experiencing new chest pains or shortness of breath is encouraged to talk with their doctor about their heart health options. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, Virginia News Connection.
Arizona State University, YouTube, and the video channel Crash Course have joined forces to offer students a new approach to higher education that they believe will be a more flexible way for students to earn up to 12 transferable credits. Alex Gonzalez has more on that virtual learning opportunity.
Arizona State University, YouTube, and the video channel Crash Course have announced a partnership to offer a series of online courses for college credit. Called Study Hall, it's a chance to take courses for credit and aims to address issues like accessibility and cost. Katie Packwett with ASU says the partnership allows students of all backgrounds to earn up to 12 college credits for their first year of study on topics from math to English composition. Packwett says it's all about opening new, convenient pathways to higher education for high school students who want to get a jump on college or folks who want to go back to school.
And yes, older adults who are either working or not, but are maybe interested in going back and getting that degree, this is a great way to, again, kind of test the waters and try things out.
People can preview the courses now on the Study Hall YouTube channel, and they begin on March 7th. Paquette says those who register will pay a one-time $25 sign-up fee per course. When a student has completed the course and is satisfied with their grade, they can pay $400 to obtain the college credit. Or if they sign up before March 7th, the cost is $350. Paquette points out that some students today still want the traditional college experience, while others may opt for a hybrid or fully virtual learning. The study hall credits are transferable to enroll at ASU or other schools across the country. She explains a student can take the online courses as many times as they'd like and only pay for the college credit once they're happy with their grade and learning outcome.
There's a lot of flexibility in this, you know, particular initiative, not a huge financial commitment until you're ready to pay for that credit.
She adds these online students can expect to engage with others in the course and with the ASU faculty members who will teach them. And it's important to note there are assignments, assessments, and deadlines, just as with any other college-level course. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation.
The body positivity movement has made great strides in recent years, helping countless people overcome the shame they feel for not having a body that matches the Western ideal beauty standard. Increasingly, research is backing up the movement's aim by showing that body positive accounts online can help improve young people's body image. Catherine Carley has more on the story.
A recent study finds that when young people follow body positive or appearance neutral accounts online, their own confidence and body image improves. While social media influencers are often criticized for their unattainable filtered images, a growing number of social media stars are helping young people develop judgment-free relationships with their own body and alleviate the shame associated with being big. Writer and therapist Gabes Torres says the movement taps into people's most intimate desire to be loved and be seen.
Even though I look like a certain way that doesn't match the beauty ideal that's been prevalently shown in media, in movies, etc., this movement says that I belong as I am.
A recent study found that people who viewed as few as one body positive post a day for 2 weeks showed decreased body dissatisfaction and were less likely to compare their appearance to others. Similar results occurred with appearance neutral posts, which encourage followers to focus on what a body can do rather than what it looks like. Torres notes that body positivity can be about more than just tackling low self-esteem. It can also question capitalism and corporate interests, as well as racist or ableist ideas. Torres says that whenever a message is powerful, such as body positivity, it can also be profitable, and that many companies are simply cashing in.
Even though that perhaps within the structures of these companies, these products, they have politics that are different, that contradict what a lot of folks who are in the movement believe in.
Torres says certain skincare products, for example, may advertise women of varying shapes, sizes, and colors, while company leadership may answer to shareholders or support particular lawmakers who actively support discriminatory or misogynist policies. Still, Torres notes that having compassion for others and oneself is always profit-free. For Maine News Service, I'm Catherine Carley. This story was produced with original reporting from Gabes Torres for Yes Magazine.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 3rd, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Reed Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegetoff, Catherine Carley, Alex Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Claire Rosciato. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 244-321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin. We'll be right back.